Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
Hi, John. How are you?
Okay.
Good. We're on the air. So I want to start off by saying good evening and welcome to the Coffee Klatch. This is Marianne Russo. Tonight, Chuck is hosting our chat over at the TCK hashtag. And we'll be taking some of your calls later in the show, and I'll give you the call-in number when the time is ready. I am thrilled to have back John Elder Robison, New York Times bestselling author of Look Me in the Eye. His second book, Be Different, Adventures of a Free-Range Aspersian, comes out in March. And he is also a much sought-after national speaker, advocate, and he holds a seat on the board of Autism Speaks. He's featured in Psychology Today. It's just incredible. Look Me in the Eye is a humorous, heartbreaking, and really startling at times book. It's very inspirational. And I'd like to just start off by reading a bit from the book before we start the interview. I was seldom laughing and happy and never surrounded by kids. I didn't fully understand the reasons why, but I knew their situation was better than mine, and it hurt to see what I was missing. As I moved through school as another marginal kid, my dad and my teachers started forecasting my future. They told me I would never amount to anything. They said I was headed for a career pumping gas or jail or the army if they would take me. I was contrary and I would not apply myself, but I'd show them. Well, John, you sure did. Welcome back to the Coffee Klatch. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, thanks for having me back on with you again.
You know, the book is extraordinary, and your entire life is extraordinary. I mean, I hope everyone's read the book because it really is just so well written. And, you know, it's humorous and it's sad, and it's just fantastic. And, you know, I was wondering, when you were writing Look Me in the Eye, did you have any idea of how important this work would turn out to be? I mean, you know, what you've done for the autism community in such a short time is incredible. You know, when you started writing the book, what were you thinking?
Well, I just thought it would be amusing stories from my life. I didn't really perceive myself as having done anything particularly incredible. I just thought that I did a sequence of things, and the combination was unusual, but I didn't think any single thing was all that noteworthy in and of itself. And I had no idea it would be received as it has been.
You know, it's incredible because there are so many others. I mean, you were not diagnosed until you were 40, and that was by chance. You know, a chance meeting with someone that came in, I think, to look at the cars that you were working on. So, you know, you really went through your life not having any idea why you were different. And, you know, I want to, you know, talk a little bit about the book itself, and then we have so much to go into because, I mean, your life has just changed so much. And, you know, you've become so active in the autism community since the release of this book. You know, Look Me in the Eye is, you know, for those who haven't read it, is a compilation of stories about growing up undiagnosed in a neurotypical and very chaotic world. I mean, you know, your home was very dysfunctional, and you wrote about that. Your brother, I think, actually even made a movie. You know, and you wrote often about the loneliness and the isolation from other kids. Now, many mistakenly think that this is by choice. So can you explain to us what that withdrawn behavior is, and why is it so hard to look someone in the eye?
Well, I didn't understand how to engage other people. I had a desire to engage other people, but I didn't know how to do it successfully. And as far as it being hard to look people in the eye, it made me uncomfortable to look in people's eyes for any period of time. And of course, I assumed that everyone else was like me. How could I know they were different? So I always figured that everyone else must feel the same way, and that's why I never understood the requests to look me in the eye. because I figured other people must have the same discomfort as me, so why would they ask me to do something like that?
And, you know, the way you wrote about it was, you know, the attempts that you would make to, you know, make friends with the kids at school. And, you know, it was just, oh, my heart just broke when I read them. But, you know, I think that there's really
I didn't describe it as a, it wasn't a heartbreaking thing for me. I mean, it was frustrating, but I didn't write the stories with the intention of making people sad. I wanted people to see just that I had, I wanted people to see that my desires were not what they thought they were back when people observed me in those days. And I also wanted young people to see that even though I had been in a place of failure as a kid, I outgrew it. And there's the promise that young people who are like me today can have the same experience.
The book is so inspirational. Because it is these stories of how you struggled, and you know, and you know how you've overcome and you've thrived, but you know it had to be very difficult. I mean, you described yourself as the class clown and as the trickster, and you had wrote that, you know, I would make the best of my lot in life being a defective child. And, you know, I think about that, and, you know, a lot of kids and a lot of adults tell me that they had this feeling of being defective because they were so misunderstood. There was no autism or Asperger's back then. So do you think that that feeling, that defective feeling that you write about, is that something internal, or does that only come from external sources?
Well, you get the idea that you're defective when you watch other children, and compared to them, you are. It was my considered observation after watching other kids and then looking at my own situation relative to them.
Yeah, you know, because I hear that so many times the kids say that, and I often wonder, you know, if it wasn't for the reaction of other people, would they still feel that way? So, but, you know, it's
well,
a hard
could,
way to
how
go.
How can there not be reactions from other people? If you're around other people, they react to you, and you base your opinion of yourself on what you see.
True. And, you know, you grew up also, you know, you didn't have the best surroundings also because, you know, you grew up in a very dysfunctional home that you write about. You moved quite often. You know, looking back on that, you know, did that have an impact, do you think, on you're overcoming everything? Because, you know, it must have been very difficult. I mean, it would be difficult for a child without Asperger's to have to go into all of these new environments all the time. I mean, you moved quite often. How often did you move around?
Well, we moved, I guess, four times, you know, when I was old enough to really know it. A lot of kids move. I don't know that is a particularly terrible complication. I think that if you're different, you're going to be different no matter what.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess you didn't really, you know, there were no other kids that the adults in your life had dealt with that were like you. So, you know, there was really nothing to compare it to. So, you know, you really had a tough go of it. And, you know, I think a lot of parents and teachers get very hung up on the repetitive behaviors and the kids that won't look them in the eye. You know, so for the parents and the educators out there, I mean, how would you explain that to them?
Well, most of my behaviors were calming for me. I did them because they felt good. And in some cases, they would lead to me getting teased and ridiculed. I think that if you have a kid whose behaviors get him into trouble with other kids, I think you should tell him about that and explain it to him. But I think a kid who's just harmlessly flapping his hands or, you know, flapping wings or doing stuff like that, which I used to do, as long as he's not having trouble with other children over it, what's the big deal?
Right. I mean, you know, people have to not get hung up on it. You know, it is a self-regulatory tool, you know. You know, what surprised me when I was reading the book, you know, I kept going through it and thinking, you know, you seemingly had a lack of sensory issues. I mean, unless maybe I missed it. I mean, you mentioned liking the feeling of pressure, but, you know, not much else. Did you have sensory issues when you were a kid? I mean, a lot of people
ask me that a lot since Look Me in the Eye came out. One of the things they ask me is they say, how could I be on stage with a rock and roll band because all the autistic kids they know have trouble with noise? And I thought about that quite a bit, and I actually have a story. I have two stories about that and Be Different. One of them talks about how I taught myself to lock on to patterns in the field of noise so that I am following something and it makes me comfortable and I don't become upset by loud noise fields most of the time. And how I learned that at a concert, actually, for Doug Flutie's foundation, his autism foundation. And then I have another story in Be Different called Underwear with Teeth, whose name should be self-explanatory. And that talks about my troubles with clothing when I was a kid.
Okay, yeah, because you don't mention it in the first book. And, you know, I just, you know,
well,
most kids
remember
do have sensory
issues. Well, remember
that the
first book is... The first book is just a collection of stories of my life. It doesn't really purport to be an all-encompassing guide to autistic behavior. It's just, you know, what life was like for me.
Right. Right. Oh, it's so good. It really is such a great book. You know, I love the way you wrote about your frustration at a young age at things being, you know, off or not exactly right. And, you know, it was just so well written because I think, you know, any parent that has a child that has this issue would just, you know, just jumped right off the page. And, you know, when I thought about it and I was reading about, you know, your new book that's coming out, you know, I had to smile because of the exactness, you know, the difficulty and the need for you to have exactness in making the cover with the trains.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know,
I'm kind of proud of that, you know, when they got the idea to put trains on the cover of this book. And I thought, well, that's a great idea. We'll use my trains. And it turned out it wasn't all that easy to do, to get the correct trains and so forth. But I'm kind of pleased with that and how it came out.
It is great. And, you know, and especially when you know the story, the first story, and then it's when you read about, you know, why the trains were important to you on the cover, it really is such a great story. And, you know, Alex Plank, who... you know, is terrific, helped you do that. So it's great. We're going to talk about your new book coming out towards the end of the interview because I want to hear all about it. I haven't been able to find much information on it. Another thing that you write about that I think is so important, especially going into adulthood, is you write about logical empathy and inappropriate expression. And, you know, you had wrote about, you know, how putting so much thought into basic social conversation like small talk or, you know, people when you were working in an office would gossip, that was very difficult for you. So how was that difficult for you, and has it changed at all?
It's difficult because a person who's not autistic has some level of automatic or instinctive sense about the dynamic of what's going on in an office or on a date or at lunch with people or any kind of social situation. So they have some kind of sense of what's happening and how they should respond to the situation. I don't have that. Now, since I don't have that, I can teach myself. You know, I can teach myself that a person who stands with a particular bearing, that probably means they feel a certain way. Or I can teach myself that an expression means something, and I can learn how to act in a way that will lead to success in dealing with that person most of the time. But it's always harder for me to do that because it's a conscious thought process where in someone who is not autistic, they'll see the same thing I see, and it elicits in them a feeling, and they act upon the feeling all automatically. They don't have to think about it. So it's not stressful
right.
for them. That's why it's tiring.
You know, and that really stood out to me because, you know, I was thinking, well, you know, in an interview I watched of you, you had said that, you know, you've learned how to react socially. So how did you learn to compensate for the lack of, you know, natural social conditioning? You know, how did you acquire that? Because that's something that all parents want to know, how to help their children as they're transitioning into adulthood, how to acquire that social conditioning.
Well, first of all, it's important to realize that I did not learn to compensate for the lack of anything. I was not aware of exactly what was different about me. At the time I learned how to evaluate, say, people's expressions or bodies or whatever, I did not know that my ability to do that was any different from anyone else's. I just knew I was less successful in social situations. So as far as I knew, I was adopting the same strategy that every other person used. It was only when I became aware of autism that I realized that the strategies I was using were not necessary for people who are not autistic. So I taught myself in the only way that was available to me, you know, since I didn't have an instinctive emotional reaction, all I had to work with was my logical brain, my analytic abilities, and I used those to the best of my ability.
You were, like I said earlier, you were 40, right, when you were diagnosed?
That's right. And by that time, I had learned to get by pretty successfully in society. So I had already taught myself how to engage other people. Now, it's certainly true that when I learned about autism and I learned the reasons that I was different, that brought about a quantum leap in my social success. And it was hugely beneficial for me to learn about why I was different, because with that knowledge, I was able to dramatically increase my success in dealing with other people. But I would certainly want to be clear, especially to parents who are listening, that I had achieved an acceptable level of success entirely on my own, and if I could do it, young people today can do it too.
Absolutely. And, you know, Karina Becker has said last week, she was telling us that for her, getting the diagnosis was just such a relief that, you know, it made sense of all of the struggles that she had, you know. Did you feel the same way?
Well, sure, because, you know, you grow up thinking that you're defective, and to realize that you're not defective, you're part of this group of people who are like you, that's a very liberating thing. It's great. I think it's it was a very good thing for me.
And, you know, you've done so much because, you know, you went on, you were, like you said, you were on the road with KISS because, you know, you went on to be an engineer designing, what, I think, video games. And so how was that for you, you know, before, because this was before the diagnosis, right? So how was that for you, being on the road with KISS and, you know, having all of these really incredible careers? Although you did write that you hit a wall with the corporate world, that wasn't for you. So how did everything come to be? Because that you also have an extremely successful business. I think it's, what is it, J.E. Robinson Automotive or something? It's a fantastic business you have.
I never perceived myself as being tremendously successful. It's funny that when I worked at Milton Bradley, we designed some of the first big electronic games in the 70s and early 80s, and I felt like I was kind of a failure at Milton Bradley. But the Discovery Channel was doing this special on me this summer, and they got Jake O'Donnell, the president of Milton Bradley, to talk to them about me, because, you know, he knew me then and he knows me now. And, you know, Jake recalled me as being a tremendously successful engineer there, which was like totally opposite how I perceived myself at the company. So clearly there was this disconnect between how I saw myself and how maybe the management saw me. But, of course, that was only Jake. It's possible that other management saw me in yet another way.
And, you know, we were on the road with KISS. I mean, that had to be an incredible experience, you know, for you. So, you know, but I guess, you know, in the end, none of those are really your niche. And, you know, you were able to find your niche in the writing and, you know, in your advocacy work. And, you know, what is your feeling about it? I love the way you say eccentric, not weird, because it's so true. And, you know, when you write that, you know, what is the feeling behind that? Because is that how you grew up feeling, that you were just weird?
Well, how else could I feel? People told me I was weird. I think that when you're a young person and you're different like I was, that's how people see you. You're a dangerous freak. And it's only when you become old enough or you do something that attracts some kind of widespread recognition or acclaim that you turn from being a freak to being a pleasant eccentric. I think that's true for any young person, and that is the tremendous disadvantage that young people with Asperger's labor under. They can be really extraordinary and exceptional people, but if they haven't done anything to make a place for themselves in the world, they are likely to be dismissed by society and marginalized. So that's a hard thing to get through, but you have to achieve things in life to get past it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's where, you know, I don't know what your feeling is on the, you know, neurodiversity, but I mean, you know, if there was even a study, I think you even wrote about it. I know that, you know, many of us, you know, were talking about it, is that, you know, there is so much autism. There's, you know, this explosion of autism in these affluent communities. Well, it's because of the brilliant minds. And, you know, like I like to call them gifts. A lot of people don't like that. But, you know, it's really the focused interests. And, you know, if you think about it, that's why they're so in such affluent and successful careers. So, you know, what is your feeling on neurodiversity and about the, you know, the success of a lot of people with autism?
I think that that's something that's not really well understood. I think that there are a lot of highly successful people with autistic traits. There's no question. I mean, I'm a pretty successful guy with autistic traits. Temple Grandin's pretty successful. Then you have people who are described as, say, having Asperger's, people like Bill Gates, who have never described themselves as autistic or disabled in any way, and yet people observe them and they say that about them. I think that while it's true that autistic differences in the brain can be a key element of some of the creative genius that moves society forward, we can't overlook the fact that too much autistic difference in the brain or different kinds of autistic difference in the brain lead to crushing and total disability. Really, if you think of three things that autism can affect, autism is a communication disorder. So if you're a person whose ability to read the unspoken signals of other people is impaired, you could be sad. You could die of it. You could become so depressed you kill yourself. So it's no laughing matter at all. But you've got a shot at having a career if your language is good. If you're a person who has severe language impairment, you are really, really disabled in this society. If you are a person whose ability to communicate through the use of your body is severely impaired, as in autistic people with tremendous coordination and physical challenges, that's another crushing disability. So it's unfair to our larger autistic population to say, well, nobody with autism, you know, needs any kind of help. We just need to be accepted. That may be true for people like me, but it's most assuredly not true for people who can't talk and can't live their lives independently and fully.
I agree, absolutely. And I think that that's where a lot of the diversity in the autism community comes from. And it's really a shame because the child who is on the severe end of the spectrum, who is without language, who, you know, is just suffering horrifically, you know, that parent should be looking for a cure and should want change for that child. And everyone needs to accept that there are people
really,
like yourself that... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Cure is a really hard word for people because, you know, the people who are perhaps more like me, where they have good command of language and they're socially disabled, those people hear a word like cure and they think, get rid of people like me. And they find that offensive. Somebody who has a child who can't talk, you know, they say, I want a cure. What they mean by that is I would like my child to be able to have a conversation with me. And I cannot imagine any parent who has a child who cannot talk who would not want their child to be able to have conversations. You know, what I say is I say that a cure for autism, just as a broad-based thing, is probably not desirable because I think that there are good sides of autism, like I've described. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do our very best to remediate the components of autistic disability, and we should be able to make those tools available to people who want them. If we have a therapy that can help somebody who is nonverbal talk, that may not be of any interest to me because I already talk. But for someone who can't, I mean, that's a life-changing thing. And we need those kinds of things in the autism world.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm known for saying I don't really believe in a cure for anything. I think that you find treatments and management tools and, you know.
I think that's right. You pick the components of disability and you try and find things to remediate that. You know, you don't try and change the whole person. You try and help the person talk, or you help the person with digestive trouble. You help the person, you know, with whatever thing they struggle with.
Well, I think that's so much of the confusion of autism, because there is very high-functioning autism, and then there is very severe autism. And I think that, you know, unless you're really living in this autism community, a lot of people just are unaware of that. And, you know, it's really just everybody accepting everybody else's view, especially among, you know, the parents, because, you know, a new parent coming into this autism world, you know, shouldn't have to be choosing, you know, where to go for support or resources. And, you know, everybody has different needs, and the more information that's out there, the better. So,
well,
you know,
that's a nice idea, but I think it's fundamentally flawed. The reason I think it's flawed is that one of the key components of autistic disability is that most of us with autism have an inherent difficult time putting ourselves in another person's shoes for a variety of reasons, and it is hard for autistic people to naturally recognize alternate points of view. So if you're a young person with Asperger's syndrome and you are well-spoken and articulate, as you feel you don't need a cure, you just need acceptance, it may be very, very difficult for you to recognize that somebody else who is, you know, your same age and grew up in a similar family to you but can't talk is actually a person with the same neurological difference as you, but to a significantly different degree. So if you feel you don't need help, you think, well, why does he need help either? It's hard to see other people's points of views for autistic people.
That is a great point. You know, I never even looked at it that way, but that is actually a great point.
And it extends to the parents, too, because
there's
such overwhelming evidence that autism is a large part of the time a genetic condition, that if you have that disability in the children, you may have it to a lesser but still real extent in the parents. And they may be what I would call proto-autistic people. They have some traits, but not enough to be diagnosed as disabled. And those traits certainly might make recognition of those things inherently difficult for them, too, just as it does for me. like people look at my son, right, with Asperger's, and they think, well, how could it possibly be that this Robeson guy is so smart and he didn't even know his own son had Asperger's until he was a teenager? But there it is. I didn't, because I just couldn't accept that idea. And I thought, well, he's so much better than me. He can't be. And yet he is.
And, you know, so many parents don't, you know, once their child gets the diagnosis, that's when, you know, the light goes off in their head and they go, wow, you know, when I was a kid, and that's when they start to see that they had these traits as well, you know, and then they didn't even think about it or know about it until their children were diagnosed. But, you know, I wanted to move on a bit, you know, for the sake of time, we have a lot to go through that. You know, you're really making an impact also for the educators, which is so important. And Look Me in the Eye has a teaching guide now by Dr. Kathy Dyers. So it's being taught at Elms College. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that, about this teaching guide and your involvement in it, because that is what is so needed.
Well, we have a college guide that we developed at Elms College for Look Me in the Eye. We also have a teaching guide that's available on my website, johnrobeson.com, and on the Random House Academic website, that was made by Asperger students and Asperger teachers at Monarch School of Houston, Texas. So if you want to use Look Me in the Eye in a high school or middle school environment, that is the guide you want to download. It's available for free on both those sites. And when Be Different goes on sale in the spring, I will have teaching guides that were developed by the Model Asperger Program at Ivy Mount School in Washington, D.C., and the Asperger Program at Monarch School in Houston available. So we're going to have two points of view for middle and high school usage for my newest book. And I think that's really important. And those guides are developed not just by teachers, but they're developed by actual young people with Asperger's who put their own input into what ought to be talked about in the book and why.
I can't wait to read it. I really can. I mean, it's just going to be fantastic because it really is very different from, you know, what I'm getting from it from the first book. And, you know, you do have this, you write about Monarch School and Elms, and you also teach there, right? You're an adjunct professor, I think, there?
Yeah, that's
so
right,
you
yeah.
Teach courses there?
Yep, you can actually go to the Elms website and sign up for my classes. I have different Asperger courses. I'm doing like four a year now. They're one graduate credit courses, and I'm doing them on weekends to accommodate people who travel from out of town, because I get people coming from, you know, Maryland and New Jersey and stuff like that, and by doing it on the weekend, they can fit it in.
Now, the online versions of the classes that you're developing now, is that something that's going to be useful for parents, or is that just for educators?
I get parents in my classes, sure, and we are going to, we have to do a lot more videotaping to take the Asperger Mind class that I do at Elms College and put it online, but we hope to do that by this summer. And I also have classes at Elms on using Look Me in the Eye and using Be Different in high school and middle school teaching environments. And those, I guess, you know, clearly those are for teachers. But I get a fair number of parents in the other classes. And also, you know, I do workshops all over the country, and I get countless parents at those.
I could imagine. You know, it's incredible. I mean, what's happened since this book came out. And, you know, you've been going in a lot of different areas as well. I mean, you've become very active in the community. You know, I don't know if you're comfortable or not. If you're not, we can just go past it. But are you comfortable talking about the transcranial magnetic stimulation?
Sure. Yeah, I'm comfortable talking about it. You know, my son Cubby and Alex Plank are doing this Autism Talk TV project. You can just type Autism Talk TV into Google. And the kids have an episode that they just put up on TMS. And they actually show Alex going to the lab and getting TMS. And then they have my son Cubby talking about his experiences in the TMS program. So I think that anyone who's interested, I'd encourage him to look there. And then I also have some stories on TMS on my blog. You can just type John Robison blog into Google, and it's right under the heading of a blog. But I think that TMS basically is a tool that allows us to reach into the brain non-invasively and turn up or turn down different portions of the brain. And in doing so, we may be on the cusp of some tremendous breakthroughs in neurology, some of which will benefit autistic people.
You know, my cousin is a neurosurgeon, and over the summer I was actually discussing it with him, and it really is very promising. And, you know, to me it sounds almost like there's a shifting of energy in the brain. Am I just way off on that? It just seems like it's pertaining to the energy in the brain. Is that correct?
Well, it sort of is. I mean, in a general sense, if you turn down the area of your brain by your left ear, the area of your brain by your right ear, in a rough sense, rises to compensate. So, yes, there's a balance from side to side in your brain. And what happens is people sometimes think, it's like a zero-sum game. Make one part smarter and another part gets dumber to compensate. And while it would seem that way, at first blush, it's not really true, because what happens in disability is you get two parts of the brain working against each other. So one part on the left side might be pushing forward, while another part on the right side is pulling back. And if you suppress the part that's pulling back, then the part that's not pulling back can surge forward, and you actually have less energy usage in the brain and more constructive output. So it's not a zero-sum thing at all. You can make yourself significantly smarter and better. And that's a real important point.
You know, shifting of energy in the brain and in the body is really the way of the future for a lot of different disorders, and I have some upcoming guests that are finding that in other disorders as well.
Well, I
so,
think
know,
it's stroke recovery, epilepsy, and, in depression. I think that you're going to see it in a lot of places.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad you're, doing the work that you're doing. And, when I was reading about it, as far as what you're working with, you had said that the transcranial magnetic stimulation was making you more engaged. What did you mean by that? What positives are you seeing from it?
You know, what TMS has done for me, TMS turned on emotional responses to things I experience. I describe in Look Me in the Eye how I have always had powerful emotions inside my head. I would get really happy, really sad, really anxious. I have the same feelings as anyone, and they're very strong feelings. What I have never had is I've never had an emotional reaction to something I saw. Like I might see, you might fall down, and I look at you and you don't look injured, and I think, well, big deal, get up, after some of these TMS experiments, I see things, and those things I see elicit feelings in me. And that's something you can't learn. At the beginning of this interview, I said that I taught myself to see things, and I taught myself the expected response. But that is fundamentally different from seeing something and having a feeling. And that's what TMS has given me. And that is a powerful pathway out of social disability for people like me. That's a big, big deal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Man, I'm thrilled for you. That's great. And you had written in a previous article, and when I had was reading about the TMS, that I remembered what you had said previously, and I was just curious. You had written that gifts diminish as more normal relatedness with others increases. So if that's the case, has the TMS affected your creativity at all?
I wrote the first book. Before I did the TMS, I wrote Be Different Efforts, so we will see what the wider public thinks about my creativity in this next work. I don't think that my my intelligence is diminished by TMS. I don't think that.
Oh, no, not at all, no.
It's very hard for me to say if I would be less creative, and if I am less creative, what would be the reason for it? I don't know that I can answer that. But like I said, we'll
know,
see what the public thinks when the book goes on sale.
Now, TMS isn't as that's not something that is widely used right now, right? I mean, that's something that's still in
TMS is a research tool which is used at places like, you know, it's used at Harvard Medical School, it's used at University of California, it's used at University of Louisville. I mean, there are a few universities around the United States that are doing research with TMS. TMS has been FDA approved for the treatment of depression in a certain application, but no, it is not a widely available tool. And I would urge people to keep in mind that we're talking here about science, not a treatment you can go out and get. So you can't just go sign your kid up for TMS treatment for autism, but that may become a reality in 5 years. In fact, I think it will be a reality in 5 years.
It's also leading researchers in a direction also. So,
it's a big deal. We're just not there yet in terms of offering it as a treatment to the broader public, but that is absolutely the objective. And I'd also want to stress that the objective of this research is not to work with people like me who are already pretty articulate. It is to work with people with much more severe disability. And I have started out as a research subject because I'm articulate, because I can do these experiments and I can describe what happens to me so that we can develop tools that will work for people who have less ability to describe what happens more effectively. But that is ultimately our goal, to help people with severe disability through this.
Right. And you know, a lot of kids that are, you know, not high functioning, so this is great, and adults. You know, last week I had Dr. James Coplin on as my guest. And, you know, he was saying that it is his opinion, and, you know, I consider him to be really an autism historian. He really goes far back into the history of autism. But he was saying that history shows that the end result of childhood autism is really relative only to intelligence and not to early interventions. And when I thought about that interview and when I thought about doing the interview with you, I was thinking about your childhood and, you know, the dysfunction, lack of support that you had. And, you know, I was wondering, what do you think about that? Do you think that early interventions really make a big difference, as, you know, a lot Dr. Temple Grandin and a lot of other people do? Or do you think it runs its course and you grow out of a lot of the difficulties?
Well, I think with all due respect, I would disagree with your previous guest. I would say that, first of all, there is general agreement in the medical community that I am familiar with that intelligence is the strongest predictor of one's ability to emerge from the shadow of childhood disability. So there's no question, mm-hmm. the smarter you are as a child, the less likely you are to be a disabled adult if you're a child with a difference. But it is also true that every study that has looked at the effectiveness of early intervention has shown it to be both powerfully effective and has shown its power to be magnified the earlier we intervene. And in fact, now we are looking at studies that will explore the possibility of intervention when children are in a pre-autistic infant state. If you can imagine such a thing, well, we might be able to head off counterproductive autistic changes in the brain that would have led to severe disability.
Well,
so
let's go into that.
Early intervention is a big deal.
Yeah, I agree. And he did. You know, I mean, the book basically is about all types. It's a fantastic book. It's about all different types of treatments and really helping a parent understand what the different treatments are. And he does advocate for early intervention, absolutely. And he thinks that it is very helpful in their transitioning and, you know, in their progress. But, you know,
but it's true. Intelligence is the biggest predictor of success.
Right.
That doesn't mean that intervention isn't important, though.
Right. And, you know, you know, as we were just talking about, you know, there are two areas of study that you would like to see more research in. And one of them was studying geek success and the brilliance of the autistic mind. So, and the other is attacking the environmental part of the puzzle. So if you could just go into those two things that you would like to see more research and interest focused on. And then we can go back to what we were just talking about.
Well, at Autism Speaks, we recently funded a 25-year study where we took a population of approximately 700 people that were profiled extensively by a young psychiatrist at the start of his medical career in the 1980s, and we're going back and finding those people as middle-aged adults, and we are seeing how life has turned out for them. And we are trying to extract from that study of those 700 some people what the secrets of success of those people who were successful were, what the trip points were for failure for other people, what you know, beacons and hazards there might be. That is with a population that was diagnosed with DSM-3 autism, fairly severe autism in the 80s.
Right.
Nobody has really ever done a study looking at these geeks that are described as having strong Aspergian tendencies and being socially inept, and yet they are enormously successful. And we can all think of people who would fit that criteria in universities and technology companies around the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be interesting to look at the lives of a population of such people and see if we could learn how those people's paths differed from their more neurotypical and regular peers, and mm-hmm. if there are secrets to be got from a highly successful population that could be handed to the large population of people with what's so-called high-functioning autism and Asperger's, and yet those people are unable to find gainful employment, you know, and you may know people like that yourself. They're really smart, and they're really good talkers, and they're really nice, but they can't get a job. So what sets
right.
them apart from people like Bill Gates? And I think that if we could learn some of those things, I think that would be a very valuable piece of knowledge.
Absolutely. And the second one was attacking the environmental part of the puzzle, and you said that that would be surprisingly not what people would think.
Well, I think that when people talk about the environment, they are very quick to seize one thing and jump on it, whether that thing is, you know, it's mercury in vaccines or it's lead or, you know, whatever. They think that the environment to most people is the one thing that they have on their mind, and I think the reality is that the environment is an incredibly complex combination of the street noise where you live, and is that noise overwhelming to your child with an autistic proclivity in his brain? It's the sounds. Maybe are you ingesting, you know, smog from passing buses, and is your child particularly susceptible to that? You know, there's just an infinite array of environmental factors that every developing child grows up around today.
And the
problem is how do you connect those factors to autism? That's a really, really hard thing. One thing I would like to say, though, is that at the most recent Autism Research Grant review meeting that I attended, because I sit on these boards where we review proposed research and we rank it, we saw a significant increase in the number of applications for people wishing to study environmental issues, and they were very diverse. They were studying sounds, smells, chemical contaminations, vibrations, you know, all sorts of different, but each of the things, you know, you would read it and you would think, yeah, that could be a real thing. Absolutely. And so I was very encouraged to see that we have researchers who are making plans to study this, but it's a really complicated thing to unravel.
And you know what you were saying before about, you know, having testing for pre-autism in these kids, because early intervention could be really, really significant. So, you know, there's a lot of research going on out there that is going to make a very, very big difference in the next couple of years, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years, but, you know. And I have been following, I do follow your website and your blog. I mean, your blog is just fantastic. And that also is on, what is it, johneldrobison.com?
The blog is jerobison.blogspot.com, and then I have another blog on Psychology Today, so you can people can find it in both places. The pre-autism thing is really interesting because the science is suggesting that children are not indeed born autistic. Because we're not born with all of the structures to be autistic in our brains. So as our brains grow, some of us experience growth down one path, some turn down another path, which may be less productive and it leads to autistic disability. So if we can detect a pre-autistic proclivity in an infant, and we could then develop a therapy to head off having that child turn down an autistic pathway in development, that could be a powerful, powerful thing. And I know that some people listen to that and they think, well, doesn't that mean that I would propose to get rid of somebody like me right at the start? And no, that's not what I mean, because we are seeing that there are thousands of what will probably be a combination of environmental and genetic causes for autism. Some of those causes may touch you lightly, like me, leaving you a person who can have exceptional gifts as well as some disabilities and you could do okay. Other causes may be like sledgehammers and they leave you totally disabled. So if we can detect those sledgehammer causes before they actually hammer the person into serious disability, that offers the promise of helping that group of people without, for example, altering the group that I happen to be in. So that speaks to both the people who wish to be left alone and to the parents who want something to help their disabled children. And I think that that's
absolutely
the kind of direction research is leading towards in the future.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if there's any research being done, but one thing that I always think about is, you know, these kids, and not just with autism, but with a lot of different disabilities, is developmental disabilities, is, you know, it's so difficult to educate them. These kids have such a hard time, especially in the teen years. And, you know, I would like to see, you know, some type of profile done to see if we had schools taught differently, if kids were taught by their learning style instead of you know, having a conformity to teaching. So if you had a pattern thinker, word thinker, visual thinker, you know, almost like the multiple intelligence theory.
Well, we have schools to do that now. You can go to a place like Ivy Valley, you can go to Monarch, and you'll see that.
Well, that's what, is that what Monarch is all about? Because, I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, one plays into the other, the self-esteem, the depression. I mean, it's so difficult for these kids. And, you know, I think that all kids could succeed if they were taught in the way that they can be taught with their, you know, learning style. So, you know, that's something I'd like to see, and I'm glad Monarch is doing it. So I would assume it's very successful.
You know, there was a movie, Billy the Kid, a couple of years ago. It was a documentary film about a teenager with Asperger's in a high school in Maine. And they were filming him, and there were scenes of him, like, in the cafeteria and classrooms and stuff. And I looked at him, and he just had this terribly uncomfortable expression all the time. He looked like a hunted animal. And that was just how I felt in school. I felt like a hunted animal, and I wondered what was going to try and get me next. And I had seen that so many times among children with autism in schools. And yet there are some schools that I go to, and Monarch and Ivy Mount are two examples, where the kids don't have that hunted animal look. And, you know, and that tells me that the strategies that some of these special schools are employing are working. And, of course, you can look at the success of the children who come out of the programs, too. That speaks to their effectiveness.
Absolutely. You know, I hope that they become a model for other schools, because I really think that's what's needed. And, like I said, not just for autism. So, John, let's hear about it. Be Different, The Adventures of a Free-Range Aspergian. What is this book about?
Well, the people who read Look Me in the Eye often would say to me, in your book, you say, I taught myself to do this, or I taught myself to do that, and you don't really explain how. So I wrote this book, Be Different, with the idea that I would tell the stories just the way I did Look Me in the Eye. You know, I have these, you know, sort of stupid stories of my life, you know, that hopefully will be entertaining. But
they are great.
But in Be Different, I actually explain how I did things, and I explain the underlying meaning, which I don't do in Look Me in the Eye. In Look Me in the Eye, I kind of leave it to the reader to draw his own conclusions. So Be Different has the same kinds of entertaining stories. But the other thing that Be Different has is Be Different has stories that speak to most of the components of autistic disability that touched me. So, for example, Look Me in the Eye doesn't say a word about sensory issues, but I told you that I have a couple stories about that in Be Different. Look Me in the Eye doesn't talk about being bullied, and Be Different has a couple stories about being bullied. But it still has entertaining stories, you know, so I still have stories about pig racing and rocket launching guitars and stuff. So there's still a mix of things in it. So basically that's what Be Different is. It is entertaining stories that will give deeper insight into how we think than Look Me in the Eye did. And I hope that the stories in Be Different will be more directly translatable into action for young people who will read the book. Because I really tried to speak to those people who would say to me, tell me how you did it. And I've tried to, you know, I've tried to do that with this book. And still at the same time be entertaining.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be another New York Times bestseller, because I mean, everyone who's read this book, I mean, your first book would just rave reviews, and I'm sure that everyone is going to love this. I know I can't wait to get it. So I can't really say
what will happen with that, but I certainly can say that Be Different contains my very best quality of thought. You know, I thought really hard about what people wanted from me in this next book, and you know, some people suggested that I should write something that was more like a work of entertainment or, you know, general interest, and I don't think that's the case. I think that the people who read my stuff, you know, they kind of have a stake in the game, whether they're autistic or they have a child with autism or they have students in their school or whatever. But I feel like people wanted more insight, and that was what was lacking in Look Me in the Eye. So I have tried to remedy that with this book.
You know, I was fortunate to spend some time with Temple Grandin, and, you know, people, I mean, I don't know if this happens to you, but people just swarm her. They just love her, and they just, you know, they just go to her for encouragement and information. And I remember, you know, turning to her, and I said, well, what is it like to be so loved? And she said, it's a huge responsibility. And, you know, do you feel that way? Because, you know, you just, people look to you. Because your first book was so good, and what you've done since this book came out is just incredible. I mean, it's only a few years, and you've just done so much for the autism community. So,
well,
you know,
I do feel that, because,
awesome.
You know, when people when people take what you say so seriously, and that's evidenced by how they respond to you, I think that you do have a duty to give those people your very best quality of thought when you answer them. You know, you can't give people flip answers because that's, you know, I mean, you have a duty, I think, to you have a duty to not do that. And I think that's what Temple says, and I feel exactly the same way. You know, if you go into something, if you go into writing with the idea that you're going to be an entertainer, well, then sure, you're just an entertainer. It doesn't matter what you say. You don't expect Jon Stewart to give you serious advice about how to live your life.
Right.
But I think that a mom with a child who looks at somebody like me and she thinks, well, he's a successful grown-up, and the thing I want most of all is for my son to be able to grow up like he did and have a job, I think that's a person that obviously deserves the best answer you can give her.
Right.
And so, yes, there absolutely is a responsibility that you feel.
Well, I admire you. I respect you. I think what you've done is just incredible. And like I said, we're really looking forward to the next book. I hope you come back when it gets released. Is it in March, I think, March or April?
It'll be March 29th. And sure, I can come back. And I'm going to be traveling all over the country for Autism Awareness Month in April. So we can do a radio show one evening when I'm on the road, and we can talk about what's happening with the book when it's on sale. Yeah.
Yeah, I would love it because I'd love to, you know, really promote it and get parents out there buying it and then have you come on, and maybe we can take some of their questions. But, you know, I really thank you for coming back, and, you know, what can I say? It's just it's an honor to have you. So let us know whenever you're ready to come back, and I'm going to be following your blog and Psychology Today because – parents, you should really follow it. It is so informative, and it's very well written. So thank you for joining us again, John.
Also, you should tell people that they can find me on Facebook, too. I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/John Elder Robison, and that's also like a PG-rated community if you have young people that want to go to it.
That's true, and, you know, I follow you there as well, and you give a lot of information there. So it really is. It's great. Well, thank you again for joining us. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care, John.
Yep.
As
good night.
I am the show every day, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Thank you for joining us tonight on the Coffee Clatch.
Good night.